The EPA Alumni Association is proud to present the documentary entitled Anthrax Cleanup on Capitol Hill. This documentary was directed and edited by Shen Wang, a graduate student at the University of Pennsylvania, in cooperation with members of the EPA Alumni Association. It begins with the following words being typed out on the screen: October 15th, 2001, Washington, D.C.
About 10:30 this morning, my office opened a suspicious package. This was the biggest biological attack in our nation's history.
Something that we knew was an ongoing concern, an ongoing threat.
With a new sense of awareness of the danger that terrorism brings to us.
On October 15th, 2001, a staff member in Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle's office was opening a letter and noticed, you know, this burst of dust.
We contacted the Capitol Police and the Capitol Physician.
So within 15 minutes, they were able to identify that it was anthrax.
It wasn't just the Hart Building.
Approximately 20 other offices besides the Daschle suite where we found contamination.
This was the fourth anthrax incident that had occurred in a month.
In Florida, in New York, here in Washington, D.C., and elsewhere around the country.
Five people died. 11 people in total got inhalation anthrax. Another 11 got cutaneous anthrax.
Just about a month after the 9/11 attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, the country was in a very frightened mood.
EPA was called in immediately to help organize and pull together various people and with the right expertise to do this cleanup.
It was just so new for everyone.
It was the most difficult response I ever had in my career.
Many, many agencies involve hundreds and hundreds of people realized this was a national issue of immense importance to the agency.
Anthrax is formed by this bacillum called Bacillus anthracis. It develops this protective spore covering around it, so it can live in the environment for long periods of time. So what happens is after the spores enter the body, they germinate, you know, back into bacteria, and they multiply and secrete toxins, which really harm the body and produce tissue death. There are two relevant forms for the bioterrorism incidents. One is the cutaneous anthrax, which you get from contact with the spores. The other kind of anthrax is the inhalational anthrax, and that's the kind that's really more serious. You get it from breathing in the spores. So before these incidents, historically about 75% of people that got anthrax would die.
There hadn't been any inhalational anthrax in this country for, I believe, over 50 years.
The weaponizing meant that whoever developed the spores coated them with some sort of material that kept them apart.
When the envelope was open, the particles were so fine, it was like a cloud came out of the envelope.
And they apparently had been treated in a manner that allowed them to aerosolize very easily, so just touching them could send them off into the air.
By the time Capitol Hill had the Daschle letter show up, if you remember, this was back around 9/11, and I went to the World Trade Center. I had 2 days off. It was a weekend. The following Monday or Tuesday, I got a call asking me to go down to the Capitol.
The Hart Building and the Daschle suite that's in the Hart Building, the spores arrived in a letter. And the letter had gone through what we call a mail trail to get there.
Of course, it came from Brentwood. Brentwood was very contaminated. And then when it came into the Dirksen mail room, they would sort through the letters, and then they would band letters together for the various offices. So when the letters were compressed, it squeezed the contents of the envelope out. And so that contaminated the machine, so everything else that went through the machine ended up getting contaminated. It contaminated the cart, it contaminated mailbags.
The second was foot traffic, because when this episode occurred, you know, workers got up from their desks and went over to the Daschle suite, you know, the people that were nearby, what happened, and they went back to their offices.
They were found in 11 or 12 different locations on Capitol Hill.
Capitol Police Board recognized they didn't have the expertise to know what to do and how to do it. They didn't have cleanup people in the legislative branch, so they asked the executive branch to help them do this.
It called NIOSH. It called EPA, the Air Force, the Army.
Centers for Disease Control, Department of Defense, FEMA, Health and Human Services.
But there was nobody that had responsibility of cleaning up the place. Under Superfund, we could look at anthrax and consider it a pollutant or contaminant under the law, which allowed us to use Superfund to clean it up.
We all thought that somewhere in the military there's probably these resources, right? And if you remember from the movie E.T., when they were keeping the E.T. from being discovered, there were dozens of big white panel trucks coming out to the house and disgorging dozens of people in white suits, and they were able to isolate it and do anything that needed to be done. So we thought that I'm sure this is going to be the same thing here. At some point, there's going to be a call. There's going to be dozens of trucks coming up, and they're going to handle everything. And the Department of Defense representative said, no, it's not like E.T. We just don't have that capability. So you look around the room, and who had that capability? The capability to do it, if it could be done, was going to be the EPA. We brought the expertise of doing hazardous site cleanup, hazardous waste cleanup, over many, many years.
The anthrax response was unique in that EPA historically has always been involved with chemical spills or oil spills. And here was an instance where it was a biological release. Historically, to my knowledge, there may have been an incident somewhere else, but nothing certainly to this extent.
We called upon any agency that had dealt with biological materials before. And what we were told at the time, at the very early stages of trying to evaluate what to be done, that it was never done before. There never had been a large building contaminated with anthrax spores that was successfully cleaned.
So we actually had to have some training from NIOSH and from what was called the CHIPM group with the U.S. Army on how to do the sampling and where to go for the analysis of the samples.
So, basically the first thing we needed to do is be confident about how contamination had spread throughout the building.
Is there contamination? How much contamination and where is it?
So in the first 2 weeks of the response, that's all they were doing. A lot of sampling was done, focusing on the mail trails that they were following.
One of the other advantages EPA had in the waste program is they had contractors that they could activate right away.
Every day we might have to go in and sample floors, you may have to sample various center offices.
My very first entry was into the Ford office building where the bomb squad's gear, which we knew was contaminated, was suit up in PPE. The level C, we were pretty much isolating ourselves and sealing all openings with duct tape so our masks were connected to our suits.
There were basically several methods for doing surface sampling. One involved swabs, which were good for crevices and things. One involved wipes, which were good really for especially hard surfaces. And one that NIOSH helped develop was used a vacuum cleaner and a little sock. And that was good for porous surfaces or complicated surfaces to get spores up.
Our vacuums were basically backpack mounted.
You would do 30, 40, 50, 60, 100 samples.
Total, during the response, there was 10,000 samples pulled.
We have the best healthcare and environmental sampling teams we have in the nation working on this situation.
A number of different agencies to be on a team. So no, we didn't make a decision on our own. We all sat together in a conference room at the command post and worked these responses.
So the incident command system that we had, we didn't have it in the first week or two. And what prompted it was because of the lack of communication and not having a real good organizational structure, we inadvertently contaminated about 20, 30 people. I spoke with the commander of the strike team. And we said, look, I don't care if anybody else is using Incident Command System, EPA and the Coast Guard are going to use it.
Incident Commander was named by the Capitol Police as being the person in charge who would be seeking the advice and guidance of all the other agencies in the federal government and then making their recommendations to the Capitol Police Board, who would make the decision. Think of it as this large tree. And up at the top, you have the incident commander, and then you have all these branches coming from it with the different agencies who had different functions, and then you had their little incident command structures underneath them.
So we would all get assigned either a building or a portion of a building or assigned to do coordination with other agencies.
EPA did a really good job of that. They did what we call full inspection characterization sampling, in that they sampled 100% of the areas of interest.
You know, you had all this sort of, we came to call it tertiary contamination. So primary would be the envelope itself, secondary might be the machine, and tertiary might be a letter that was in the bag sometime later that the Daschle letter itself had been in. The most contaminated out of any of the anthrax letter sites was probably the mailroom and Daschle suite.
The Daschle suite, the issue there was it was everywhere. So in most offices, it might be only on a desk or a chair or a small area over there. But in the Daschle suite, it was much more widely dispersed.
Another challenge. What would be the best way then to make it safe, to clean it up when it hadn't been done before?
Can you do a surface cleanup, or do you need a fumigation? At that time, any pesticides that would be used to kill anthrax spores was not registered.
Under the pesticide law, a product has to be either registered or exempted from the law before it can be sold or distributed in the United States. They need to go through a review process at EPA that a plan would be submitted to something like a remediation action plan that detailed all of the chemicals to be used and how and where.
At each building, you had to make the decision which fumigant to use. At the Heart Center office building, the decision was to use chlorine dioxide.
There was a panel of experts put together. So they named several chemicals.
There was no silver bullet. All of them had advantages and disadvantages. There was a long history of using power formaldehyde for decontamination. The problem was formaldehyde is animal carcinogen, a human carcinogen. You couldn't use ethylene oxide. Ethylene oxide is a very good sterilant, but it's explosive and you have to do it under highly regulated circumstances. It's also a carcinogen. And it was between vaporized hydrogen peroxide and chlorine dioxide. And vaporized hydrogen peroxide breaks down much more easily than chlorine dioxide. Chlorine dioxide is acutely an extremely hazardous chemical. Why are you dealing with an extremely hazardous chemical? Because these spores are hard to kill.
And he gave me the number. It was John Mason, who owned his company, who had supplied the chlorine dioxide. So I called John. So he came out and he brought his equipment and everything, and we actually scrambled a really, really big aircraft to put all this equipment on in Texas and fly it up here.
Chlorine dioxide had never been used for this purpose before.
The on-scene coordinator folks decided to test the chlorine dioxide at a little bit larger level, something equivalent of a room. They used truck trailers.
We were able to do that over at Brentwood at the post office, gave us some space. We had to go from this little experiment that was done at bench level to full scale. It's not extremely difficult, but there's a lot of things that you have to change.
Concentration of the chemical, the contact time, the temperature, and the relative humidity. So there's four factors right there that all have to be carefully controlled.
We tried a variety of different operating scenarios. Over the course of about 3 weeks, the whole Capitol building, the Supreme Court, all the various congressional and Senate office buildings. I mean, it was a huge area, and we only had two laboratories that could do it. And we were running operations, you know, 24 hours a day at any one time. At that time, we had about 300 people working in the field.
We were learning on the job. It was on-the-job training. From each site to the next, we learned, and the process became more robust because the remediation action plan was the way in which we could enforce that they would follow more rigorous standards.
Good afternoon. I'm Lieutenant Dan Nichols. I'm spokesman with the U.S. Capitol Police. I called a press conference today just to give you a situational update.
There was only two areas that were fumigated, and that would have been the HVAC system that services the Daschle suite and others nearby, and also the Daschle suite was fumigated.
Initially, the plan was to fumigate the entire building. And the people who worked for the Senate saying, well, EPA, first you said to do the whole building at once, and then you say do one, just the Daschle suite. What are we to believe?
And that idea soon was reduced in scope to, we're just going to treat the room. that has the highest concentration, but not the rest of the building. If there are spores found in other parts of the building, they'll probably be at a very low level. We can treat that with bleach or something else, just clean it on the surface.
And that was a very important decision because, in my opinion, if they had tried to fumigate the entire building at one time, it would have been a failure, and they would have had to go on back and start all over again.
Here's how the process works. The gas won't be effective unless the environment is warm and moist. Steam is pumped into the suite until humidity levels reach between 70 and 80%. Meanwhile, the chlorine dioxide gas is generated in an aqueous solution outside the building. The solution is then delivered via piping to the office, where an air stripper emits the ClO2 into a gaseous state. It is then distributed in the suite using ducting and fans. The process delivers a uniform concentration and thorough treatment throughout the contaminated area.
We did the actual fumigation very soon after Thanksgiving.
We isolated Daschle's office, sealing cracks, sealing doors, sealing ductwork, to then create that environment that they're gonna, you know, again, pump in the chlorine dioxide gas. If you picture the building as, you know, a big box, Daschle suite is just one little box in that building. So during the fumigation was sort of like all hands on deck. It was a period of time where once you set up, turn the switch, you start fumigating. You can't stop until a certain concentration, time, temperature, pressure, humidity is reached for a certain period of time.
Other factors that must be monitored. So you have some remote sensing going on, but then also you want to make sure that it's effective. You don't want to have things leaking out and going on different parts. So there are people that are in the building making routine trips and monitoring gas concentrations in other locations. What he's mentioning is a trace atmospheric gas analyzer, TAGA, TAGA. So they're monitoring outside of the building.
There are notebooks. It's funny because it has all the rooms, room 610, room 615, and concentrations, and who's in each room. Bookshelves are missing in Daschle's suite. Where are they?
The spore strip data came back. It's looking real good. It seems to confirm what the environmental samples show, that we had very efficient kills throughout the suite.
As it stands right now, the goal is for the Senate to come back on Monday and for the House to come back on Tuesday.
One night, Fred came up to me, and there had been this very heated discussion between the two sergeant-at-arms of the House and the Senate. He put his arm on my shoulder and he goes, "Rich, by Wednesday morning you're going to have to figure out how to open all these buildings, or Thursday EPA won't have a budget anymore."
The EPA was under enormous pressure to get it done because important people had been displaced from their offices.
We had to work crews extended periods of time. And it was really like, you know, working 7 days a week, 18 hours a day.
It was very difficult. Some of the meetings that I was in and having to deal with the administrator, with the senators, with Senate staff, was getting them to understand that they might want it all cleaned up in 2 weeks, but it just can't happen.
One of the big problems in chlorine dioxide fumigation is keeping the humidity up. In a trailer, when we had done the trailer test, we had just used a bunch of these humidifiers, and they had virtually no effect when we were in the Daschle suite. We actually tapped into some raw steam line to raise the humidity inside the Daschle suite. Tap into the lines on the ninth floor, went into the atrium and dropped steel pipe down to the sixth floor, and then over into the Daschle suite. And we did all this in the middle of the night. We had to go to Home Depot, have him come down and open up his place so we could get in and buy the pipe. We did all this sort of improvising as the night went on.
After we did the suite, we did the HVAC system.
However, about 3 o'clock in the morning, it was determined that there was a mechanical problem that developed. They stopped the process.
Well, what had happened was we used inflatable bladders that we would stick inside the ductwork and we'd blow them up, and that would block off the connection between the air inside the offices and in the HVAC system. Set up our operations in the parking garage. We were watching the temperature go up, temperature's good, and the humidity was starting to go up and looking good, and then it just got to a point it really wasn't where it needed to be, so we introduced more raw steam. Finally got it up to where it needed to be, and then we started to introduce the chlorine dioxide. And somewhere during the middle of the night, there was one area that we just couldn't get the concentration on. At about the same time, we started to notice that the whole parking garage was starting to smell like chlorine or something. You know, eyes were starting to itch. My chest was starting to kind of get uncomfortably tight. And then later on, I was like, it's just too strong for that. So I went outside and I started looking around. We found out later that one of those bladders that was in the HVAC system blown up because we introduced raw steam. The raw steam heated it up too much and that failed. And so now all the chlorine dioxide that we're pumping in to the HVAC system is escaping and making it down into where we were at.
We're picking up now where we left off a couple weeks ago when we had difficulty getting the humidity up. We've made a lot of modifications to the system. We have redundancy in all of our probes, and right now we're mixing the chemicals and injecting steam, getting ready to begin fumigating the HVAC system.
When the building was evacuated, people left everything. It's like you hear when people have to evacuate from a plane that has an emergency. Don't take your luggage, don't take your, just go. Well, that was like that for the entire building.
So you go into a room and you remove all the items and you bag them up and they were shipped off to be gassed somewhere else.
Personal items, the furniture, that a decision was made at the building on the Capitol Hill to send off for decontamination or disposal would come down to the Peace Street warehouse. And in some cases, we had made the determination that items were clean because they were treated with chlorine bleach or chlorine dioxide.
Before they were allowed to be brought back, there was a committee that peer reviewed the data and said, you know, thumbs up or thumbs down, you can bring them back.
So we built this chamber where we would bring the items in. We would place what were called spore strips,
which had spores of a non-pathogenic species of bacillus. Usually they put 1 million spores on each indicator. If there was no growth, then it was considered to be clean.
In some cases, we had metal or steel that we thought could be recycled, but we couldn't get anyone to take the item. So we ended up sending what we thought was clean already to a facility that would autoclave, further sterilize or clean the items. We still couldn't. So after that, it was sent to a landfill. That's how fearful people were of the anthrax contamination. So.
Once you've completed your remediation, or think you've completed your remediation, then you have the clearance environmental sampling.
Trying to make this determination. Was the remediation successful, and can we turn the building back over for free occupancy? They started putting together this multi-agency, multidisciplinary group to sort of review all the previous sampling information.
And either the sampling is negative, if it's not negative, you may have to go back and do more remediation and do another round of clearance sampling. And that was first used in an informal way at the Capitol Hill anthrax site. Once the building is cleared, you have to refit it. You have to put in new furniture.
I didn't think that when you go back into the room afterwards that it would look as bad as it did. But think about it, if you fill up your house with steam for 3 days, it would look terrible. That's what happened.
One day, we would be going back into the Hart Senate office building, the Longworth House office building, the Ford House office building, and that's, in fact, what we're doing today.
The Capitol Police Board came back to the group and said they wanted the entire job to be wrapped up by January 23rd of 2002.
We had a couple incidents that caused us to delay a little bit. There was this one room that had a Hart Building address, but it was actually in the Dirksen Building because the buildings are directly adjacent to each other. They share a common wall in some places, so it wasn't on our blueprints. We walked up and we opened the door, and it had never been touched. It was still just like it had been on October 16th. So we had to hurry up, quickly assess that room, drove the samples across DC to get the samples dropped off, and in the middle of that, we had the second crisis present itself. The architect of the Capitol Carpenters had been taking down all these barriers. They had cut in to one of these bags behind the urethane foam, and a couple suits had fallen down on them.
So basically, this is a bag that had apparently been left behind by first responders back in October.
It turned out We were very lucky that the bag that the guys cut into had no contamination on them at all. But we didn't know that, and we'd exposed all these workers. They all had to get the nasal swabs. They had come downstairs after this and had blown themselves off with the high-pressure air because there was all this dust that was coming down, which was like the worst thing to do if they had been contaminated with anthrax. Every day there was, he went from one crisis to another crisis. If you've ever seen the movie Groundhog Day, he's in a situation where every morning he wakes up and it's the same day again and again and again. And that was sort of the way things were for us at Capitol Hill.
We ran out of the number of people we could within the Philadelphia regional office. We had on-scene coordinators come to us from other regions of EPA. Another one of the fascinating concepts that we had to deal with was, how clean will it be, will we make it such that the people would be comfortable going back into the building? When we went to the expert, no one could tell us what level is clean enough to be safe. It never had been done before.
The people in Congress and the general public would think that there are zero spores left in the building, but we never can guarantee that at this stage of science. We can say, and that was the criterion, that there's zero spores found in all the clearance samples that were taken, so that all those samples were negative. But the samples don't cover by any means every square foot of surface, and the air samples don't get out the total volume.
We would say, here are the levels that we believe would not cause undue harm, and here's what we did to show you that we met those levels in the cleanup. Our cleanup level is very, very conservative. We said if we found even one spore, we would keep cleaning up until we got rid of that spore. We frankly thought people weren't going to buy that, but people did.
Noon Eastern Time, here's a bird's eye view of Capitol Hill, the U.S. Capitol building right in the center. The Hart Building is in the upper right corner of your screen. It's northeast of the U.S. Capitol. And today was the first time the building has been cleared for occupation. Senate Majority Leader Daschle among the first to go inside the building today, stopping briefly to talk to reporters before entering.
Good afternoon, everyone. I know I speak for the entire Senate family in saying that it's good to be back. There has been very frustrating and trying months over the last period of time, but I must say that we have always felt that it was important to put safety over convenience. I want to thank especially those who are behind me, our Sergeant at Arms, our Secretary of the Senate, the staff of the Rules Committee, the Center for Disease Control, the EPA, and all of those who worked so diligently and courageously over the course of the last several months to make this day a reality.
Roughly 90 days before the buildings reopened.
It was a success that I believe our country needed.
So many people involved, so many important people who were affected by it.
They were really great people. They were very supportive. Once they got to know us and we developed some trust, it was quite an experience, as you might imagine.
Good. So is our staff already?
Your staff is there?
Oh, yes, they're there.
Waiting to see you.
At work.
I was happy to be done when we got done, Hart and Daschle, and ready to go back to some other sites and to go home.
The other buildings, their cleanup work started after Capitol Hill.
When they were able to do it, they would learn from what we had done. So we were making the rules, so to speak.
In my career, it was definitely the most interesting, most challenging incident I was ever involved in. The opportunity to work with various agencies, that's not something we routinely do.
I met more people in the 10 years I worked on this issue than I did in the previous 30 years.
We worked many hours, morning, noon, and night. We learned to work at a high-stress environment. Carbon dioxide, yeah, a little bit. You know, that scared me a little bit. You know what? Heat stress and fatigue probably scared me the most.
Realizing how important it was to the country and how important it was to the sense that people all over the world would see that we were able to handle something that's never been handled before. The training we had put into our people and the processes that we had set up were confirmed as being effective.
Because we were the only ones in the country that had actually responded and remediated an office building, we were an asset to Tetra Tech, and they made sure that We gave training for biological sampling to the trainees.
If I had to look back on this and say what could have been improved, when this started out, EPA had not yet sort of fully embraced the whole incident command system thing, which is like a way to organize a response. And we recognize that as a sort of a weak spot for us. But we fixed that. In fact, the whole country fixed it.
Incident command system was then adopted. And it wasn't just because of this. It was also because of the World Trade Center and the Pentagon and some other national incidents.
Since the anthrax attacks, several years later, a Department of Homeland Security was formed, and they created a national response plan, which specifies much of how cleanup organization would be structured and what functions there would be and what agencies would be involved. The National Response Plan was since modified to be called the National Response Framework. It was a lot different then than it is now.
The idea of having this review working group, which is the Environmental Clearance Committee concept, provided a model that was then used again for successful cleanups.
Streamlining the process was another thing that we learned. We actually registered several products and they're listed on our website. We also thought about a way to have an exemption put in place that would allow OSWR and other federal and state agencies to react much more quickly. This would be sort of a preemptive exemption. The science of what we were doing was critical. All the decisions had to be based on sound science. That was a given, but it wasn't just sound science, it had to be the best available science.
We were trying to do preparedness for future attacks and coming out with playbooks.
In 2005, the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy requested agencies involved in these issues to form an interagency work group to write out this guidance so that in the future, this happens, somebody pick that up and say, well, I can follow this guidance pretty well and I can develop a site-specific plan based on that guidance. It's called Planning Guidance for Recovery Following Biological Incidents.
I always have felt doing your homework is important as a scientist. Go back and read what's been written about these attacks. Do some homework about the past before you plunge into the future.